Thanks, guys. Are you guys excited about being here?
Yeah.
Thank you. I know we're not live yet. We're waiting. Okay, we're live.
Oh, we are live.
Yay, we're live. Woo! All right.
Hi. How are you?
Hi,
I'm David. Nice to meet you.
All right, hold on. I got to do my thing.
Oh, sorry.
All right. Hello and welcome to another episode of the CG Garage. This is episode number 100. Thank you so much. I appreciate it. I have never done a live podcast before. This is my first time doing a live one. I'm usually sitting up in a very small room in Culver City.
Yeah, and you're behind the big mic, and now you look like you're doing the ShamWow. Like we've got the side mic, so we should be at the Costco.
Doesn't it look like a pimple? A little bit.
Yeah, I didn't notice it amongst the other ones. So it's kind of hidden camouflage.
Thanks, Dave.
Yeah, you're welcome.
So this is 100 episodes.
Yeah.
Just a little over 2 years. Yeah. Our listenership has gone up a lot. And I do one every week. Do you guys listen to the podcast at all? Yeah?
Some.
All right.
Some few.
Yeah. All right. Okay. So there's been some amazing guests over the last 100 that we had. It comes out you're in LA, so it comes out Sunday evening in LA, but that's Monday morning in Europe. So I figured everyone gets a chance to see it to start their week off. And we've had some really cool guests. What are some of your favorite episodes?
Some of my favorite episodes, not the ones with me.
Yeah.
On. Those are not the good ones. Those are not good. Yeah. I liked the Shaheen.
Shaheen one?
The Shaheen one was Shaheen Tusi.
Yeah.
Amazing nuke artist.
He just doesn't shut up.
But he goes on these rants that are amazing and surreal. And he actually spoke about a specific bug in nuke for Tron that was discovered during the shooting of Tron.
Oh, yeah, he did. Yes.
That is still available in Nuke, I think.
The error message.
I think it's still a thing.
He did say that.
Yeah.
Who are some of my favorite? One of my all-time favorite ones was with Norman Seeff.
Mm-hmm.
Norman Seeff, if you guys don't know who he is, he's a photographer who's photographed, like, every celebrity in the world. You guys know the Steve Jobs picture like this? Like, he did that photograph. He did the picture of Ray Charles. He's done every rock album in the 70s. He's an amazing guy. And he was at an event I was at in Portugal, and I didn't really know what to talk to him about. And then suddenly it dawned on me that I'm doing all this research on digital humans and the uncanny valley, and somehow he's able to capture people's souls and really get their emotions out there. So I said, all right, we're going to talk for an hour about digital humans, and it's an amazing podcast, really, really good one.
He kind of talks about the creative. I mean, that's one of the things I like about this podcast is it goes into. It's not just you have a guest and we do a movie and this is how we did it. It's actually talk about the creative process behind a lot of this stuff and just like creativity in general, the challenges that face the industry. The good, the bad, and the ugly about like multiple industries too.
Yeah, well, that's the thing about luckily because of the product that we make, we actually reach out to a lot of industries. So visual effects is a big one, obviously it is.
Yeah.
But we also do automotive design, architecture visualization, product design. So I actually get all these different kinds of points of view. I mean, last episode 99 was Art Gensler, the head of Gensler Architects, and if you guys don't know who that is, that's the largest architecture firm in the world. So that was a really amazing one. And it's really cool. Actually, one of my favorite things to do is with my buddy Dan Thrawn over there.
Is he the one with the beard? Where's the beard?
Yeah, there he is.
That's an impressive beard.
It is an impressive beard.
Nice beard.
So he and I like to talk for 2.5 hours about something. And usually, we did one on Star Wars. That was a pretty good one. We talked about the only three Star Wars that matter. It was episode 5, 6, and 7. And then we did one on Mad Max, which was incredible. Incredible. And coming up very soon, probably next episode after this one, will be the one we did on Jurassic Park, which is also... They're really good. They're a lot of fun. Dan's, if you don't sit down and have a conversation about movies with Dan Thrawn, it's a blast.
And for those of you in streaming world, if you're not familiar with this podcast, if you like this one, You have 97 others
that's right.
that you can listen to.
97?
97.
Why are you discounting
Because there were
two
with Lon and myself. And you can, once again, just yeah.
It's a skip though.
I mean, unless you're really stuck in traffic, maybe.
All right.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was.
Thank you, Tim. Yeah, you know what? I can't play it in front of my five-year-old.
I didn't want to spoil that one because we're going to talk a little bit about it, but it is, the one with Tim is fantastic.
Witty. It was really witty. It was like BBC America.
You've got a face for audio podcasts. That's right.
Painfully handsome.
Painfully handsome.
It hurts, literally.
All right.
So I have a question for you.
Yes.
This is number 100.
Yes.
What is obviously we did not expect this. I don't think to get to this level in terms of listenership.
Or yeah.
So like what for you has like been the biggest surprise over the course of these 97 episodes?
You know, I don't know. Well, first of all, let's talk about the fact that how you helped me with this. Because I was driving in the car, and I said, I want to, because I listen to a lot of podcasts. I live in LA, so traffic is, thank you very much, right? I live in Burbank, work in Culver City, so podcasts have saved my life. And so I decided, all right, I can do this, because I listen to Nerdist podcasts. That's, as you know, it's been one of my big inspirations. And I said, all right, I'm going to do that. And I went to you, yeah, because you did the Modcast, right?
I did, yeah.
Right,
for the Foundry, right. Mixology, yeah.
And I said, well, what do I actually need to do? What are all the ingredients I need? And I figured out I needed some microphones, a mixing board, and some kind of a service to upload this stuff to, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And that's it. And it was actually really low investments. And what I decided to do, based on what I saw from the Nerdist podcast, is I'm not even going to fucking edit them. Right? I'm gonna curse, I'm gonna say whatever the hell I want, and I'm just gonna do it because editing them takes way too much work, so whatever we have, it's good.
You're like a rated R Terry Gross. That's you.
All right. So that's what I did, and then I just put it up there and see if anyone listens to. And I think one of the things that surprised me happened with Melissa. We were walking on the streets in Stuttgart.
You can't see her, but she's right over there.
Walking on the streets in Stuttgart and at FMX, and someone came up to her, and because she's done several podcast intros, and goes, oh, you must be Melissa. So Melissa got recognized for being on the podcast in the middle of Stuttgart, Germany, so that's kind of funny. So, yeah, I appreciate it. Those are the things that are surprising to me. Actually, surprising to me is the fact that people say they want to be on my podcast. Like when Joe emailed me yesterday, say, hey, I'll be on. I was like, oh, okay. Thanks, Joe. I really appreciate
it. We'll pay you later. I'm sorry.
So, people want to be on, and I think what's nice is having really good, honest conversations, and those are wonderful. And I think the comments I've gotten have been unbelievably positive, so those have been great. All right, you guys ready to start this thing?
Yeah.
All right. As you know, Brady Harris has written and composed the theme song and will be performing it for us live today.
Welcome to the 100 CG Garage, where the chaos group talks. You'll know it's over when the last bucket drops. Gonna fire up rays in high dynamic range. We know that ambient occlusion is passe. Global illumination won't save you day. My image-based lighting is very swell. But you need to make sure everything has fur now.
Ladies and gentlemen, Tim and Joe. Thanks, guys. Okay. All right.
Joe and I are going to start this podcast by making out.
We didn't talk about that.
It is streaming.
We like each other.
Well, you guys are old friends.
Yeah, sort of.
Yes. And you guys...
I haven't been over Joe's house, so That's kind of the basic definition.
Oh,
of
is it?
Yeah,
you're invited anytime.
You haven't
anytime.
Been over for fondue, and I haven't.
Yeah. Let's do that. But, no, yeah, we met. Yes. I remember meeting Tim 2005. I came over to Blur when you guys were on Venice Boulevard. And I was a huge fan of Blur Studio. I probably, if I remember this right, when I was learning 3D Studio Max in architecture school, I feel like Blur might have done some demo scenes that they included when they shipped it.
Well, you
wrote plugins or something.
Yeah, a couple of our guys wrote the...
Oh, yeah, the demo scenes that came with Max.
I think so.
Yeah.
And that's how I kind of taught myself Max, because I deconstructed those scenes to figure out what the hell was going on in them.
And we gave away plugins, and then we wrote the Ray Tracer. Some of our guys wrote the Ray Tracer. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
For
and then Joe stole a Halo job from me.
Did I?
Yeah. I remember. You stole it. And you took it to...
Oh, yeah. We talked about it on the last podcast.
Wait, which one was it?
Starry
Night?
The big one, yeah.
Starry Night?
Yeah.
That was a Blur thing?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, he wanted to direct it.
But I'm not bitter.
It's all a fog at this point. I just remember going over to Blur in 2005 and meeting Tim, and he made quite an impression just seeing him in person.
Yeah.
And,
he is handsome.
We didn't say what kind.
Very handsome. Very
kind
handsome.
Of impression.
Very handsome. No, I just remember that Blur, the culture, the environment of Blur felt like no other visual effects house I'd ever been to, and that's...
It's very comfy.
It's comfy. It's...
Yeah.
It's great. It's, Tim has a desk down with all the artists. There's no hierarchy there, even though he's the big shot. And it continues to this day, I think.
Yep.
We just did a couple jobs together.
Assassin's Creed,
and
Doom.
Doom and some other stuff earlier this year. So, yeah.
Yeah, no, it's, I hang out at Blur as much as I can because, I work with some of the artists who do some crazy stuff in my lab stuff. So Kevin Margo and I, actually Kevin even has a key to our office, believe it or not. which I told him he can keep it because if he needs a graphics card, he knows where they're stored. So he's been great, but I love going to Blur. It's just a very friendly environment and everyone's always welcome. And like you said, Tim just sits in the middle with everyone else. And if you need to get to talk to Tim, you can just go right up and talk to him.
Right.
So
no, it's great.
It's not like I used to have.
It's not as
much. There was a dead zone around my desk of like anybody didn't want to sit where I could see their monitor or anything like that because if they were web browsing, I would go, hey. No, I wouldn't do that.
Now they're all packed around you.
Now they're all. Yeah, they have no choice now. Yeah. They really have to. But people have always, it's weird, ever since we started the studio, people come by and visit and they go, hey, this feels pretty comfy here. And I don't know I don't know how you quantify vibe. You know, what is it that people see that go, this feels good, like a good place to work? Which the only thing I could say is I think it's some combination of people generally looking engaged in their work and a little burble of happy talk. I don't like cubicles. We don't have any cubicles or anything like that.
But you also like keep people feel enabled to put stuff on their desk, right? It's a messy office and therefore it feels really creative. And not in a bad way, but like there's stuff everywhere. Right.
Yeah,
and so everything's out in the open.
I don't trust people that don't put shit on their desk. A clean desk, I don't trust that guy. He's like a serial killer.
Yeah. He's got a briefcase with crackers in it.
Brandon Reeves is one of our effects guys. I don't trust that guy. I'll have to turn my back on him because his desk is like an open field of shiny spotlessness.
That just doesn't sound good.
And Nerf gun fights, do those still break out? Or
no, because you'd think that a toy approved for 8-year-olds would survive, but no, two artists have gone to the hospital with eye injuries.
Really?
Yeah.
I feel bad
and
now.
And Jennifer, my wife, who runs the company now, she said, okay, that's fucking it, you're done with this childish bullshit, which was annoying to begin with, is now dangerous. And a potential lawsuit.
I should note that we did a video shoot of Blur, like a little, like, hey, get to know Blur Studio thing. And it turned out really well, I think.
Oh, yeah. I use it all the time.
Right.
To, like, people that don't know where we were. I go, oh, watch this video where we look really cool.
Because I tried to do it just like this, where I didn't actually try to script anyone. And just, like, I'll shoot Tim for half an hour, and then we'll take the best, you know, things he does or whatever. But anyway, we were trying to think of what gifts to give them, like, you know, some pizzas or flowers or beers, whatever. And I think we gave you guys, like, 1,000 Nerf darts. So now I feel a little bad about it.
Blur has got it's big, high ceiling. It's got 3 floors that are all open, so it's like perfect for sniping.
And you're in a very vulnerable spot. You're like right in the middle.
In the middle.
Except for ammo falls down from missed shots, so it's actually very fortuitous. But let's talk about Joe.
Absolutely. I want to talk about Joe, because Joe, you've come up in the podcast as part of conversation for a bit.
Okay,
right?
Now I got to go back and review these.
Sure.
Did I make
the main thing is
coming?
The architecture background, right?
Yeah.
And in fact, even in the conversation I had with Joe, we were talking about, you know, I mean, with Tim, sorry. Tim was talking about, you know, getting to direct a movie at the age of 50, right? Like, how he had to wait that long for it to happen. And it's like, for a lot of people, that's really cool, because it makes you feel like, unless you direct your first movie at 25, you're never going to make it. And that's obviously Tim's proving that wrong. And then we talked about...
Well, Ridley Scott started at, like, I think 41 or 40.
44.
Okay.
Right. Yeah, I think.
But, and Ridley's going strong. So.
But I said, you know, it's like, then we look at people and compare, like, why did this guy succeed and I didn't succeed or whatever. But anyway, you've come up because I went to Rice University when you were at Columbia University for architecture school.
Right.
We were both coming from the architecture background. And in fact, I met you the first time at SIGGRAPH when you were presenting your Desert House stuff.
Wow. So 2001, I guess.
Yeah. And then,
I was very lucky, as you probably were, where I went into graduate school or into architecture school right when the digital revolution was happening.
Yep.
If I had gone in 4 years earlier, I'd probably be an architect.
Yep.
If I had gone in 4 years later, I kind of would have missed that first wave, you know, and kind of, so I hit it at the exact right time at Columbia when we were learning Alias, which became my Soft Image.
I did
3D Studio Max.
Yeah.
Wavefront, yeah.
Yeah. But what was interesting to me about that Desert House piece specifically, right? And a little bit, now I'm thinking about it, it's a lot of the VR problem, right? A lot of people are like, I want to do something in VR, but they don't really know how to use this medium, right? And the architects had the same problem back at that time. What was the number one thing when you give an architect, he's going to do an animation, he's going to do some long,
horrible
walkthrough. And I said, the only time the camera moves forward on a film is if it's a horror film, right?
Right.
But you presented that Desert House thing as like, here's another way to tell an architecture story.
Right.
Here's something different. And you basically showed people something different.
Right.
And I think that's what got everyone's attention.
Yeah, I think, it was, there was these little animations being put out by a renderer called Arnold. Is that still around?
Yeah.
It is.
Yeah.
So they did, I'm sorry, I'm like,
was
I'm,
it,
I'm out
no,
of
it. Was, didn't you do it in Mental Ray?
I did it Mental Ray, but I remember there were these little things that these guys are putting out, and they were doing this little handheld stuff.
Oh,
and
you're
that's
talking about
like
Pippi
Land. They were like little play soldiers come to life.
Yes, it was called Pippi Land.
And that's when I started playing around in 3D Studio Max, and this was just when the Mental Ray plugin came out, which was crazy expensive, required like a giant dongle.
Right.
And and renders would go for, you know, Desert House, I think, rendered for, I want to say, 2 or 3 months.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
I had used, and they had this little motion capture thing built into Max that you could use the mouse to do motion capture.
Right.
And I kind of figured it out, and that house in Desert House was my senior thesis from architecture school.
Right.
So I just used the stuff I had,
all
these kind of things I was interested in, and made this little 2-minute short, taught myself Premiere to kind of cut it together, and that was really my first film, and it got into SIGGRAPH. It landed in this little digital fest called ResFest. Do you remember ResFest?
Yeah.
Which was cool. I mean, it was a really cool thing at the time, and someone at Wieden Kennedy saw that and gave me kind of what I would consider my first real directing job, which was a little tiny spot for Nike.
Just for contrast, that I think will illustrate the difference between Joe's style and my style, my first directed film was called So You Have an STD. I'm not making that up.
Where can we find that?
I don't know. You'd have to buy the videotape which at the doctor's office, which is we made it for, for doctor's offices.
Yeah. Someone's got to dig that out.
Is that still available?
Okay. Sorry, go ahead.
That's okay. It's good. But then I remember, like, the next time I heard about you is when I went to, I was talking with Throb. And Throb was over at Sway, and you guys did the
Mezzo. The last cigarette commercial I think ever made in the history of cigarette commercials.
Yeah. But it was clove cigarettes, right?
Yeah, it's cloves, so they're healthy.
Yeah. Sure.
Yeah.
But also, there was absolutely no cigarettes in the commercial at all. It was just people in this beautiful, serene background.
Yeah, yeah. In my mind, they were people floating in purgatory. But of course, I never told the client that. But yeah, we did this crazy, all virtual environment cigarette spot for a Indonesian clove cigarette company, and it's Claudio Miranda shot it. So that was my first job with Claudio.
It was shot on Viper, I think.
Shot on...
I know because of the green screen problems.
Viper, but I feel like we shot some of it on film because there was definitely some 120 frames per second sequences.
Okay.
I think it's been a while. But yeah, that was kind of insane what we did. We put four people in full white wardrobe in a green cube.
Right.
And I think we ended up just rotoing the whole thing. I mean,
yeah.
But yeah, pretty Sway. Yeah, we did that Sway with Rob, and those guys did a great job.
And then I was with you at Speed Shape when we were scouting the LA Auto Show to do the Saab commercial.
That's right. I did that at Speed Shape.
Yeah.
That was a spec spot.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Don't you guys feel like it was pretty cool to grow up in that time in computer graphics where literally every fucking year it was some new thing that blew you away that couldn't have been done last year?
That's true.
It's true.
Every year it was like that.
Yeah.
Seagraph was this magical trek that you took every year to see what was
something
coming.
Was blowing. Yeah.
Because the internet didn't exist back then.
I'm
serious. It really didn't.
No. Well, people make announcements on the internet.
Yeah, blurred through great parties.
I went to a couple blur parties in the.
Remember them? That's amazing.
Barely. Yeah.
Crystal Method used to play, right?
Yeah, that's right. I went to that one.
Yeah, you went.
That
to
was at the Fonda Theater. Right, wasn't
I
it?
I think so.
The Crystal
Method?
We would get fucked up.
So fucked up. And dance like our asses off. Yeah. It was great. But every year at Seagraph, it was like some new thing came out that you're like, oh my God, it just doesn't get any better than this. And then the next year, it would be, oh my God, it's better.
Yeah, it was like HDR and global illumination. And
electronic theater was this big thing.
It was amazing.
Oh, yeah.
And that's where I saw Eric Barba's Adidas spot he did with Fincher.
Oh, right.
Remember
That was amazing.
That was amazing. It's still amazing.
That Game Breaker spot was one of my favorite spots. It still is one of my favorite spots. Yeah.
Incredible.
Nike football spot.
Yep. Yeah, that's what you went and you watched it on the big screen. And it was incredible.
Yeah. But I feel like it'd be interesting if I could be 20 again. And if I would feel that same way, maybe you guys could tell us. But if you were coming up in the industry, do you feel like there's still mountains to climb? Or what are the new mountains?
Yeah,
what
is the new mountain?
What is the new mountain?
Is it VR? Is it...
VR, I think, has a role to play. I don't know if it has a role that people think it does. I think that the mountains to climb is going to be when rendering gets so fast that you don't have to think about it anymore. That would be one thing, right? I think the days of us waiting for renders are going to go away. And I think you know this from what Kevin's been experimenting with.
You know what?
I've thought that
every year for the last 20 years,
right.
And then it still
it never happens.
It's weird now because like when I was learning 3D, the only way you could learn it is you really had to go to school or you had to buy very expensive $100 videotapes that lasted 35 minutes, and you had to like try and match as best you could what they were doing on the screen. And now, like with YouTube and everything like that, the access to information.
I had to teach myself basically. I'm sure you did too.
I had an illustration portfolio, and somebody said, "Hey, we at this medical place where I made, so you have an STD." They said, "Hey, we have this system, this 256 color paint system. You think you could? It's a computer. You think you could work on it?" And I said, "Yeah, sure. I'm smart." Mom says I am. and it was great. And the minute I sat down, I thought, oh my God, this is the greatest fucking tool in the history
of
art.
And what year was that?
87.
Wow.
88. I don't know. I thought this really happened, but I was doing illustration during the day, and I did oil pastels on my drawing desk, and then at night I worked at this place that did these films, and I was working on a drawing that was due, and if I fucked it up, I would be in trouble, and I reached over on my drawing desk to save it.
Oh.
And of course the keyboard wasn't there, and then I'm like, this is stupid. This is an archaic art form. It's done. And
you're trying to save the drawing.
I stopped drawing, yeah. Which was stupid. But at the time, I thought, oh my God, I'm so, you know, prescient and future oriented. but it really was. And then you could see it is literally every art tool and ever invented, and more that hadn't been. And it's just great.
What do you think of the future, Joe?
I can't talk about that. I don't know. I was just listening to Tim talk. I feel very lucky to be the generation I am because we were there for the transition. You know, we were there for analog to digital,
yep.
And I think it's important that you started with a pen and paper. And I wonder. I wonder if the emphasis on the fundamentals is still out there, or if people realize how important it is to start there and figure out the basics.
Maybe not, but I see at Blur guys coming in and they're 25 or 26 and they're better than I ever was. Like yeah. When I stopped,
right.
When I stopped being on the box, they were already better than I
so
ever
access,
was.
So access, the access.
I don't know.
On
I don't know what the answer is. Maybe, right. Maybe that because the tools give you such a, you're not fighting the tools anymore. And so you're, because that took a lot of energy. I mean, how much energy did you spend just trying to figure out how to do
right.
what you wanted to do,
right.
much less make it look great?
It's all
right?
problem solving.
Yeah. And so that kind of goes away, and then it's how good an artist are you? Not to say it's not technical now, because I know it still is.
One thing I can say about Gnomon, thank you.
Yes,
Gnomon,
thank you, Gnomon. I've been really, really. I want to make sure that everyone knows. Like I didn't know how we were going to do this live podcast or what was going to happen. And then Gnomon just said, we have all the solutions for you to do this. And they're really great. So Lynette's been fantastic. Courtney's been fantastic. And of course, Alex, who I've known for a while, he suggested, whenever you want to do something cool with us, let us know. We'd love to be able to make it happen. This is incredible. This is an amazing place. Like really nicely
yeah.
set up.
I walked by the sculpting area, and they have this life drawing class that was going on while
yeah.
I was walking by. Unfortunately, they wouldn't let me walk into the class, but I walked by and I was told it was a life drawing.
You should have just
class.
Taken your clothes off and gone in. They would have thought you were.
That's true. I think they'd have to sign a waiver.
But no, they've been really fantastic at helping us host this.
Yeah.
So I really
but just,
appreciate it.
I appreciated that I saw a lot of the fundamental stuff
yeah.
going on here.
It's a really good school. Actually, if you guys want to know more about Gnomon, go back and listen to the Alex Alvarez podcast, because it's not just about Gnomon, but it's about his philosophy on art education, which is really, really good. And I think this is an important part of creativity and education have an important role together, and it's a difficult one to understand, because I think you need some guidance sometimes, and good schools can give you that. So,
right.
Oh, going back to your like you said, we were in that transition zone, right, in architecture
yeah.
school. Did you learn to ink and letter when you were in architecture school?
My first year, yes. In
yeah.
fact, my first year, they wouldn't let us touch the computers, and then the year after that all fell away. But yeah,
okay.
My first year was T-squares and vellum and models and all that, and then as soon as we got into the computer lab and got to sit down on the old SGI Indigos, whatever those things were called, there was no looking back, kind of like Tim. It's like, why waste my time at this point?
You're younger than me. How old were you when you got, how old are you? You're 70.
How old am I? I'm 42. So I was in architecture school from 96 to 99. So
right.
Maya 1 came out like my second year there.
Yep.
They did that clown thing, and it was just like, holy shit.
Oh, yeah,
like,
yeah, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
The clown one. Yeah,
fuck.
Yeah.
What was that guy's
name?
I met him.
Chris
Gunn.
Yeah. Yes, thank you.
Yeah, and he did the bingo the clown.
That's what it was.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, and he beat us the 1 year we were nominated, one of our other directors.
You hold a lot of grudges, I noticed.
No. He's
the Halo thing. He writes them all down in his little book.
Yeah, well, if you were 50 before you got your chance to direct the movie, you'd be a little bitter too.
Okay.
Especially if that opportunity was taken by a guy that took a Halo job from you that really was what caught the eye of Hollywood.
I don't remember taking a job from anyone, but
but anyway, yes, Chris. Well, the year we were up for an Academy Award, his short won, which wasn't the bingo one. It was the
Ryan.
Thank you.
What was it called?
Ryan.
Okay.
Which was a really interesting short.
Yeah.
What happened to him? He was doing a feature with, like, students were doing the production, right? Is it done? Is the feature done, or? Some year it will be done?
Yeah.
Cool. I just remember, that, like you said, it was every year something was coming out. And it wasn't just the technology, but also creatively, it felt like people were figuring out new ways to use these tools to do things we hadn't seen before. It'd
be kind of cool to do a film that was like, you did one drawing a day, just one little pencil drawing a day that was the next frame of your movie.
Right.
Take 20 years, who the fuck cares?
Right.
Yeah. That'd be cool. That'd be cool. So, Tim, I want to actually ask you a couple questions. I want to sort of jump a little bit.
Okay.
Last time we talked, you were in the middle of post-production on Deadpool, right?
Yes.
And there was still a little bit of that shock that came from Comic-Con that, oh, my God, people may actually like this movie, right?
Yeah.
You didn't really know if people
were going
to like
it. Oh, shit, my career's not over.
Yeah. Something like that, right?
Before it even started. Yeah.
And enough that... of course, the creative juices are going. It's like, I want to do a really great title sequence, right?
Yes.
And he wanted to do the title sequence that we were looking at earlier. And if you guys haven't seen those who are streaming, you should look up the title sequence of the Deadpool, or if you haven't seen it, go see the whole movie. But it's an amazing one. What was funny is I saw yesterday, there's a video I was talking about, like, some of the best title sequences out there. And interestingly, that one came up as one of them because it really kind of sets the tone. And what it's really funny about it is it doesn't actually have anyone's names in there.
Yeah.
Which is risky for a title sequence.
I guess, yeah. I mean, but it wasn't a title sequence.
It wasn't really a joke. It was a joke.
Yeah.
But like I was saying, you know, before we started on the live stream, it's like I showed this to... my wife's like, we're going to watch Deadpool. She goes, all right, I'll watch Deadpool with you. And she saw the title sequence. She's like, oh, I'm 100% invested. I mean, this movie is making fun of itself from the beginning, right? It just knows that humor. And that was also, like, the thing is, like, you are going to go see a very violent movie that's constantly joking around and is doing a bunch of stuff. And this is stuff that you had to prove to people that this was going to be possible, that people wanted to see this. And now, Deadpool is what, the number one most successful R-rated movie of all time? Is that correct?
I think so, unless that Jesus movie.
another girl.
Oh, Ask Jesus. Right. That might have been like worldwide. Yeah. Jesus beat me. That's okay.
All right. It's between, you know.
Second to Jesus.
Jesus
and Deadpool. And Jesus. I like that.
Yeah, basically what Jesus said.
I'll take it. Yeah.
But I mean, and I think you proved to people that people may want to see things that are not necessarily, you know, PG or PG-13.
First, I would say that that title sequence was, I would like to say, yeah, I conceived of it because I'm a genius, but one of the animatics, one of our artists, who's now our director, Frank Balson, we hadn't cast the movie yet. So he was working on previs for the title sequence because we always knew it was going to be this frozen moment. And so it was Ryan Reynolds, and then we hadn't cast anybody else. So it was the hot chick, the cool teen, the, you know, the CGI character.
Right.
And he just put him in there as placeholders. And we thought it was funny. So so we decided to like keep that joke through there and make it sort of a generic statement on the generic nature of superhero
right,
movies.
Right.
Can I just say, since we're televised now, because I haven't talked since Deadpool 2, I stepped off the movie.
Yeah.
I just want to say one thing to our geek audience out there, because it's important to me what the geeks and nerds of the world think, because they are my brothers and sisters. That, you know, I didn't want to make some stylized movie that was three times the budget. And this, if you read the internet, who cares really? But for those of you who do, I wanted to make the same kind of movie that we made before, because I think that's the right movie to make for the character. And so don't believe what you read on the internet. I wanted to do the same thing. Kyle Chandler was not going to be Cable. All this stuff that I read kind of kills me. Even when some people go, the movie was really hard to make, the movie was a joy to make. I think you see it on screen. Yeah. We all had such a good time, you know, had a little few arguments in post, but nothing more than usual. Anyway, I just wanted to, I hate people, like the crew was so great, everybody was going to come back and we were going to have such a good time, and the idea that it was a difficult movie, it wasn't, it was a joy, and it was the best experience of my life. So.
Well, we're in the age of technology. Thanks for sharing that, Tim. I mean, I think we're also in the age where of fake news a little bit, so we have to see
yeah,
that.
Yeah, I mean, but, shit spreads.
Yeah, and people, when I was reading it, it's like, this does not sound anything like what Tim was explaining to me, which is fine, and I think, obviously, people have creative differences, and that should not necessarily be dismissed as, hey, there's a creative differences, is fine, but it didn't sound like you. I just didn't think Tim Miller wants to actually make a gigantic over pot. Doesn't make any sense.
No, I didn't.
But it's fine. I think I think Ryan is dedicated to the project that he's doing, and I think Deadpool 2 is going to have a direction that's going to be and that's going to be great. I don't think this necessarily means you stepping off the project means it's going to be a better or worse.
Of course it does. No, I'm just kidding. No.
So it's just going to be a different movie.
I wish them nothing but good. I hope it's great. It was a great movie.
Okay,
because I want to see, because I love the character, and I think it's great, and I love all the actors, and I want to see them successful again, and, you know, apparently, I haven't met David, but he's a great guy from everything I've heard.
Sure.
I want nothing but the best for the character, and for Fox, too, you know?
Yeah.
They deserve to make more money. They need to make more money. So they were great. They were terrific, so.
You were a Deadpool fan. You've been a Deadpool fan for a while then, and you just realized, like, this was a property that I really, really want to.
Yeah, if you
I really want to do this movie.
If you see, maybe you can see it in the V-Ray video, but there's a wall of, at Blur, there's a two-story wall of books. Half of it, the top half, is comics, because I've been reading comics since I was 12.
So did you pick,
12.
Like, some of the characters, I like X-Men a lot, and I didn't know what teenage wardrobe bomb
Nobody
woman.
Knew.
Fast
Negasonic ball. Teenage. Negasonic teenage warhead.
Yeah. The angry teen. Or like some of these people, they're like the X-Men people, I don't quite know. They weren't the...
We were looking for new characters to add, and I would look through this big list that Fox has, and there were three. I had a bunch that I wanted to use, like Cannonball, all these visually spectacular characters, and I was making a list for the writers to have a conversation about what we use, And at the bottom, I said, I can't believe these are actually characters. How goofy is this? One of them was Negasonic Teenage Warhead.
Yeah.
The other one was Tar Baby. And I'm sorry, I know it sounds racist, but that's why I was like, holy fucking shit, this is it. How could this be a Tar Baby? And Harry Ocelot was another book. And so the writers looked at this list and said, and all the cool ones that I had identified that I wanted to use, and said, no way, man, we're using Negasonic Teenage Warhead. That's fucking awesome. Which is what they did. How she got in there.
What was Stan Lee's response when you asked him to DJ a strip club?
All right. Okay, sure. Yeah, Stan was like, I mean, we gave him a list of really foul things to say. And he wouldn't see, because we went and got the guy who actually announces the women coming onto stage. And for those of you who don't frequent strip clubs, it can be, you know, fairly misogynistic. And to his credit, Stan would not say any of those things.
Yeah.
Not that I tried to. They were just options. They were just options. Wasn't that I wanted just B-roll. But.
One thing I love so much about Deadpool is the violence. It reminds me of It reminds me of Evil Dead 2. The level of violence, there's this humor associated with it. I don't know if you know Evil Dead 2, but it's like this slapstick violence where it's funny and then you feel bad because you realize what you just laughed at is a guy being smashed to smithereens against a sign on a freeway or anything like that. Like,
yeah.
Did you go into it like what you wanted to do in terms of level of violence and knowing that this is going to be rated R, but we're going to do it in a cartoony way?
You know, I'm not a big fan of violence, oddly enough. You know, I didn't want to do any like swords slicing people in half in front of the character and guts sliding out or any of that. It just doesn't, I just don't find it interesting. In fact, when we were working on Deadpool 2 for this next version, the stunt guy, stunt coordinator Phil Silvera was going, man, let's really like open it up this time. And I'm like, no, stop. We don't. Because here was my theory on this, and it's partially taste, but also a commercial consideration, is I feel like there are people that like that extreme violence. I'm not one of them. But those people are going to come see Deadpool anyway, because it's a genre film, right? And so if I made it more violent, they may like it a little bit more. But all these other people, which is probably 90% of the audience, would not. And I don't think this is a gender-based issue, but when you test the movie, I could literally see it in the cards where we had more violence in the cuts. You see the scores go down with women. You see the scores go down with other sections of the audience too. And so the point is why would you lose those people? Why would you make them enjoy the film less so that you could get a little more shooting, blood, and gore? I just didn't think it was a smart decision, and I didn't think it was a good creative decision.
So you made adjustments based on your testing to the violence?
Yes, sort of. Like, if you've seen the film, there's a big torture sequence in the middle.
Yep.
Yes. And you found out that the longer that sequence was, there was a longer cut of that, the harder it was for people to laugh. Like, the bar scene on the end of the torture scene sequence is one of the funniest scenes in the movie, and people weren't laughing when we had a longer
cut. Because they were
still
been
affected by the other part.
Yeah, they'd spent so long in the darkness, it was really hard for them to laugh.
How many test rounds did you go through?
We did four. Wow. The first one was friends and family, and then four screenings on the lot, which was fucking great. I don't know why directors don't like it, but basically people come in and tell you what's wrong with your movie.
Yeah,
right.
And you did them on the lot at Fox. You didn't travel for
them. Is it just people that work at Fox that come to see it, or?
No, they go and they don't tell people what they're going to see.
Right.
They just go and say, do you like these types of films that are, you know, the type of film that Deadpool, so it's generally genre. Do you like Gladiator? Do you like Star Wars? Mm-hmm. Come see this film. And they do. And what's really cool is you're in the audience when they announce. I mean, you probably do this. You're like, tonight you're going to be one of the first to see Deadpool. Or Tron, and people go, ooh, shit, like, and then you feel really good because, you know, people are excited about it.
So, that's cool.
But you can literally see, and then we filmed the audience, too.
Right.
Watching the movie.
Oh, really?
Yeah, so you can see, and it was great because you'd get in an argument about, like, with Ryan and the writers, like, oh, that was funny, or which joke's funnier, and I would go, look at the audience.
Let's go to the tape.
Look, they're not laughing, so, you know.
That's a great idea.
And sometimes I would be wrong and I would go, man, that fucking killed that joke. And then you'd see the tape and everybody's like, you know. And then it was terrible because in one important screening for the executives, when the executives see this tape too, there was one guy prominent, like right in the front row, and he's like this. The entire movie.
Wow.
And it turns out that he was the guy that like set up the tape recorder, and he'd been up all night for some reason. The problem. Uh-huh. But you know, you can't tell the executives that, so all they see is this guy that, you know, is apparently put into a coma by your film.
Right. Did you do any test screenings on stuff?
On Tron, we did. Tron was tricky because our main character, Clue, was a guy in a head sock
Until
the end.
Yeah.
So that's a hard movie to test. Yeah, that's right, you were there. So we did do one test screening, which was really nerve-wracking for me, which we went and tested it at Pixar.
Oh, right.
Oh, that'd be cool.
Yeah. So we went up to Pixar and tested
it. Did the Brain Trust see it?
And the Brain Trust.
Really?
Yeah, the whole Brain Trust saw it.
So
it was me and the Brain Trust. And it was great. Learned a lot of great things. But, you know, it was interesting. They didn't like a lot of things that I love about the movie. Like, some of them hated the score, you know. Mm-hmm. So you have to take, you know, you got to take it. Take some notes, reject others, but it was overall was a really great experience and amazing too. That's where I met like Michael Arndt and Brad Bird and Pete Docter and all those guys. So it was
I remember
amazing.
When that screening took place, you were like, all right.
Yeah, it was like I feel like it was in April or something. It must have been 8 months out. So it must have, I can't imagine what that cut
was. We were getting a bunch of stuff. Like, we got to get these shots final for Joe so he can take it to that.
Previz and a guy with a head sock,
How did you get on Tron? How did... Because I've heard about like you've done
stole this Halo commercial and
was Blur gonna do Tron?
Wow,
sorry.
They love my Halo commercial.
It's kind of a it's
which
such
brought
an amazing...
it to the attention of Hollywood.
Tron. Tron was started with you know, when you first come to LA and you want to be a director, you end up doing what they call the water bottle tour.
Oh yeah. We talk about, go back to listen to the Wes Ball podcast. He talks about taking the
So you go around, you meet a bunch of executives and producers and writers around town. And one of the people I met was a guy by the name of Sean Bailey, who was a producer.
Who did you say, Sean?
Sean Bailey, who's now the president of production at Disney. Yeah. Met him, and he said that Disney was trying to figure out Tron. And they've been trying, I think, for years.
Yeah.
And this was in 2008, I want to say, 2007. And just was wondering, like, if I had any interest. And I actually hadn't seen it in a long time. I just had remembered my impressions of seeing it as a, what would have been, 7 years old, 8 years old.
Yeah.
And he kind of pitched me things they were talking about, which was in the realm of, I would say the Matrix. It was like the internet, and like there were different lands that were different websites. So you could go to Google Land or Yahoo Land or whatever the websites were at the time. And there was one was like Egypt, and one was a jungle, and one was underwater, and there was like all these connected worlds. And I just said, you know, for me, the memory of Tron is so distinct. I'm much more interested in the idea that it's the world has been sealed and the internet doesn't exist to it. It's this kind of ecosystem that's evolved for 30 years on its own.
On its own, yeah.
And what would that feel like? Like if you took the world of the 1982 world of Tron and let it evolve over 30 years to become this kind of photoreal landscape, it still felt like the 80s. What would that be like? And he was, I think he liked that idea, and I said, you know, rather than talk about it, I feel like it's something you need to see. How about I do a little test like you did? Why don't we do 2 minutes of it and see, so I can, you know, show you what it would feel like and maybe hint at this narrative, which was this kind of Joseph Conrad, you know, Hearts of Darkness kind of journey to find this person who had been lost down the river. So Disney gave me some money to do a teaser, like you did.
I saw yours. It was beautiful.
Oh, thanks.
Yeah.
Did you come over to DD? Is that where you saw it?
I don't know where I saw it. Somebody had it and showed probably that shouldn't have had it and showed it.
I'm sure. I'm sure. But we did it with like a 12-man team. I don't know if you were at DD then.
No, I wasn't at DD, but I remember the guys who worked on it.
Yeah, it was like 12 guys, and it was like 6 months.
Yep.
And I convinced Jeff Bridges to be in it somehow. Yep. And we made this little 2-minute short and showed it to Disney. And Sean and I showed it to Disney, and we convinced them to test it at Comic-Con just to see, you know, if the fans would be interested in something like that.
And we were.
And they were. Yeah, it turns out they were.
And it would never do that today.
No, because there was no script. There was, it was literally a 2-minute or 2 or 3 minute test video, proof of concept.
Right.
And they showed it at Comic-Con, and I remember being in the room, and I thought the response was good, but I don't remember it being like, I wasn't sure. And then someone had recorded it on their cell phone from like the back, from the audience. Because I was up in the front with like the Disney executives, which was like the least fun place to be for watching.
Yeah.
And someone recorded it from like the back row with the fans. And then I think that's what leaked online. And then you heard people do, you know, Tron, is this Tron? You know, because you could hear like the whispers in the crowd.
Because well, Tron was one of those, it wasn't a huge box office thing, but it was had such a cult following.
Oh, it's got a
for
weird
us,
cult.
And
it's definitely cult.
It's one of the most stylized, it's like almost like design, like just beautiful design. It's so immediately recognizable, the original one, and still it is. And one thing that's really impressed with what you did with it is you maintained it, but you updated it, but at the same time, you're right, it still is 80s, it still is... You're able
that's
to
why Joe is
that.
So perfect for that movie, because his aesthetic is so clean. And
so does the architecture come into that, your background?
Oh, for sure. I mean, that movie is all about world creation. I mean, if you're not if you don't have a design background, I don't know how you do a movie like that. Because there's so many decisions to make. And you have to love it, because there was so much building to do.
Because it was so CG, it was such a joy to work with someone who understood the challenges we were dealing with, right? As an example, I was working on the light bike sequence. That was one of the things that I was in charge of, right? And the light bike sequence, as you know, was multi-level this time, as opposed to a single one in the first movie. And we were examining, like, what would it be like to actually make all the glass look correctly? We're all reflecting back and forth. And it turned into freaking Pee-wee's Funhouse really quickly, because it was way too many ray trace reflections. And so you and I was like, no, we got to cut that down, because you can't see what's going on anymore.
Right.
So you understood the problem. It wasn't like I had to convince you. And you because you have a CG background, you understood what the challenges were.
Yeah, it was a great, for me, it was a great first film to work on.
Yeah.
Because there was certainly a lot of stuff I was comfortable with.
Right.
Diving in on that. But that was all V-Ray, right? We ended up switching halfway through.
There was Eric Barba had been using V-Ray for a while, and I guess he started in Mental Ray.
It was like in the commercial side, right?
And he started using it in Mental Ray, and then there was, not that I want to plug or whatever, but we were, the big challenge, the big thing that drove the decision was that Mental Ray at the time could not do proper 3D motion blur very well.
Okay.
And when you have, just as a technical thing, but if you have a bike, like a light cycle, traveling at 100 miles an hour on a piece of glass, if you do 2D motion blur, where you do it in post, then the reflection is going to blur, and it shouldn't. It needs to reflect and not blur. The glass needs to blur.
Right, that's what it couldn't.
So it has to, and so V-Ray could do that much faster, and there was a lot of very shiny surfaces that needed to look correct.
Do you remember the light cycle arena I had built up in my office? The big white foam core.
Yeah.
I mean, it'd be funny, I could dig it up, or I don't know if we put it on the Blu-ray, but like all those sequences were built with models and little guys on sticks, and I was shooting.
Really?
It was all previs. It was previs by hand, kind of to figure it out.
I remember
particularly the light cycle, because it was three-dimensional chess essentially.
Yeah.
It was a very
and it would
difficult
change
thing.
Shapes.
Yeah, things would change different.
Yeah,
things
and I, David Levy, who was working on designing it with it, and he actually ended up sitting right next to me so that we could look at it together and see how it was going
to
work.
Oh, that's cool. So an artist next to
a concept artist next to next to a post-production.
3D artist.
Yeah.
Yep.
It was really useful to have that.
Why didn't you do it with regular previs? Why did you do it with models? Just faster?
Started with models just because I needed that kind of three-dimensional spatial understanding as a first step, and then started breaking into shots and prevising the whole thing. But that and the disc game, which was also complicated, it was just better to have a model and figure it out, you know, by hand.
Yeah. We did a lot of stunt sequences with little men.
It's like car chases, you know, or anything. Yeah,
you have to do the sound effects.
Yeah, you can't. You have to.
It's the fastest way to communicate. I mean, like you said, a couple people sitting around a table, you can orchestrate something much quicker.
That makes sense.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Sure.
And then I worked on Oblivion with you, too.
That's right, of course.
Yeah. So that was... It was interesting about Oblivion was that it was so pretty. So pretty. And I guess you shot everything on the
F-65. F-65,
yeah, yep. Which was such a good camera in terms of...
And still, the movie I just shot, we shot on the F-65. I mean, I was looking, the date stamps on the camera are December 2011. It's right. 5 years later, and still the camera of choice, at least for the project we were working on. It's, the cameras aren't, you know, there was a while where every year a new camera was coming out,
right.
And now it's kind of plateaued off a little bit.
Well, it was so sharp and so good in low light that it was actually, like I was talking to the 2D soup and goes, you're really just going to have to up your game in terms of your noise threshold
right.
on your renderers, because they have to go all the way to like 13 or 20 stops of grain-free image.
It's very clean. And we couldn't have actually physically made that movie without that camera because of the light levels we were shooting in the Sky Tower. Yeah.
Yeah. And I kind of liked it. And I actually loved, that was the first time I met Tom Cruise, because we were doing some DigiDouble stuff with him as well. And he was, what I loved about him is because we were doing some really technical stuff, is he's a movie geek.
Oh yeah.
He loves technology. He was asking us so many questions about how we're doing things. I was really kind of surprised. I expected him to come in, do his little shoot, et cetera. No, he just kept sticking around. Like, so how do you do this?
Tom came down to Blur one time.
Yeah.
To meet Fincher, and I were trying to do this heavy metal film, and Tom was going to help do it through MGM. So he came down, and he brought a producer with him, Mary Parent, and we met, and after an hour, Fincher goes, yeah, I got some shit to do. I got to go. And so David leaves, and then another hour, and we're still talking. Tom's and Mary Parent goes, yeah, I got some shit to do. And Tom's like, I want to see some more stuff, man. Show me everything.
Yeah.
And then he stayed for 6 hours hung around Blur. And after like 3 hours, you forget that it's Tom Cruise.
Right.
And so he's sitting at me, next to me by my desk, and I'm showing stuff on my computer. And I would, every once in a while, I would look over and go, hey, that's Tom Cruise.
Not out loud, I hope.
And then one of our artists, one of our animation supervisors, is an actor, and he really wanted to meet Tom. And I said, no, you can't. We're not doing that thing, you know. And so Tom excuses himself to go to the bathroom at one point. And I see this guy like make a beeline, follow him in the bathroom to just so he could pee next to him and go, hey, how's it going? How you doing? It's an awkward meeting you here, but I'm a big fan. You know? But he was so great, so fucking like on point, interested, focused, present. It's amazing.
Well, we did all these things. We were shooting him, and I said, okay, because we have to shoot all these different expressions for the DigiDouble stuff, and he's like, all right, give me neutral, and he's like, perfect, like the most neutral expression possible. And every time we asked him, he was like a robot. I mean, and I mean that in a good way. Like, he would just repeat things over and over again. So he was really, I mean, he's a professional.
He's amazing.
He's made a lot of movies with the biggest directors in the world, including, you know, you.
Amazing to work with, yeah. It was an amazing experience to work with him. I highly recommend doing a movie with him.
Maybe he'll deign to do. Edge of Tomorrow was one of my favorite movies.
It's awesome.
Oh, my God, that movie's so fun. Yeah. I did not expect to laugh so much in that movie, because it was really, really funny.
Yeah,
it was
awesome. You know, having gone, I've done a lot of meetings with David Fincher trying to sell movie different projects. And, you know, David's the big dog in the room, which is the way it should be. So you get used to everybody talking to David, and which is great for me, because I could watch the interaction, learning the ropes, literally fucking 100 meetings. But Tom was like, Tim, what do you think? And I was like, me? You know, and it's just this really like, oh my God, I matter. And it really, it's like a powerful thing. I mean, celebrity, you shouldn't. Everybody puts their pants on one leg at a time.
Sure.
You shouldn't be overawed by that, but it's Tom fucking Cruise, and it's kind of giddy.
Yeah.
I felt like the first couple times I met Ryan, it's like, oh my God, it's Ryan Reynolds.
Right.
I got over it, but...
Okay. Eventually.
Yeah, eventually, yeah.
So what's this about heavy metal? You want to do a heavy metal movie
I always
based on the
to
cartoon?
Do.
Well, this was like, you covered it on, okay, you covered it on the last podcast because okay. I love heavy metal. Anyone knows heavy metal?
Yes.
All right, a couple right, people a know heavy metal. All right. If you guys don't know what heavy metal is, describe it. Well, actually, you would be the best person to describe it, heavy metal.
Well, there's the magazine.
There's a magazine.
Yeah, which is an anthology comic magazine of edgy sort of material. It was a French magazine, Metal Hurlant. And then it was a magazine published here forever. And they would take stories from all over the world. Mobius was
right.
the most famous. And,
sure.
And it was great because it was adult. And then in 1981, they made a heavy metal movie, which, as a young animator, was like a revelation to me because it was naked chicks on dinosaurs and so I had this idea that, you know, I was going to grow up and do Yogi Bear if I wanted to be an animator, and this showed that you could do something else and something cool. So
right,
you know, the movie, it's hard to watch now in light of the, but there's still some, it's still some of the sequences hold up great. So as an animation lover, I thought that was amazing. And then as a short story lover, the idea of anthology was just, I think it's terrific. I think short stories are all meat, no fat, and I've just always loved them.
And there really hasn't been, I mean, I think of like Shortcuts and Twilight Zone, the movie, or you know, some of that stuff. There hasn't really been.
Not a very successful.
It's not a super successful, genre. But they are, for us movie nerds, that's cool.
Yeah,
we like
well,
it.
Okay. So this was a discussion we had on the last one. You said basically that you had a lot of things that were not going for you that the studios could use against you. One was R-rated, right? The other one was animated.
Yep.
And
anthology.
So those things, there's like a recipe for disaster. But I think you already proved that the R-rated portion is is possible, and possibly
Check.
The animation side
Check.
As well. And so
well,
now you need to
some other people proved it before me, but
well,
the anthology in animation was
yeah.
is a new thing, which I think it's more plausible now in the way people consume media, where they're doing smaller bites or they're doing it while they're watching other things. So I think the idea of a great short film is really more appealing now.
And when you say short film, do you mean like 30 minutes like the Twilight Zone movie, or do you mean like 6 minutes, 8 minutes, like what's the what's
well
the
we were gonna when it was a movie, some of them were 3 minutes, like Yonan Vasquez, who did Invader Zim, did a really twisted take on Let's All Go to the Lobby, where the snacks killed themselves rather than perform the song one more time. and then we had some really great sci-fi stories. I personally was going to do this one where I love military fiction and Last Stands in particular. I'm a sucker for heroes. And I wanted the battle of the Zulus against the British, the battle at Rorke's Drift in Isandlwana, where there was this incredible last stand. And I gave it to this British sci-fi author named Neil Asher. And I said, Neil, give me that battle with orcs and elves. And he wrote this fucking amazing short story called Half-Breeds. And it was just great. So anyway, I wanted to do that, and Fincher was going to do another Neil Asher story called Bad Traveling, which is a really fucked up sci-fi thing, and it was going to be great.
Was
we had
like
Zack
Snyder, Cameron?
Jim Cameron, yeah. David Fincher, were all
that
going to
do
shorts.
That would have been
shorts.
Amazing.
Wow.
$50 million,
right?
And we could not sell it. We took 100 meetings.
Wow.
And every time, all the artists, the creatives in the room would go, this is the best presentation we've ever seen in our entire life. And then the marketing people would go, yeah, but we can't sell that. We can't sell it. How do you sell this? What's on the poster? I'm like, God, fuck me. But wouldn't it, and would you rather not, you could put any one of these shorts on the poster. It's, I know it's a little harder than the next Ashton Kutcher rom-com to make everybody understand, but I think the art form is amazing. But
right.
Maybe there's another medium that this is right for versus film.
Well, okay, how long did Deadpool stay on the shelf before it was ripe for TV, right? Or ripe for the
I think it was five years for me. Ryan and the writers had written the first draft like 10 years before that.
How long did the teaser sit on a shelf?
Four or five years,
yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, we did that right away. That was the first thing. So I was hired. the script was there. We went and did the test, and we budgeted the movie, and Fox said, yeah, not right now.
And what was the budget originally?
49.99 Because they said it has to be
under 50.
Has to have to be
So you got it there, and they said no thanks.
Yeah, they didn't like the script at the time.
How different was the script that you shot compared to the that
not
one?
At all. It's virtually the same. We cut some stuff out for budget because by the time we rebudgeted it was.
And then what'd you end up making for 59 or something? 69.
59.99 and then a little bit more when we went back and did the additional photography. But it was still, by those standards, relatively, by the, you know, Hollywood.
And it was always R-rated, right?
Always R-rated, yeah. We did do a PG-13 draft just to see if it would move the needle, but it didn't. Nobody cared.
Yeah.
I think what we want to do is... if we have a couple of questions from the audience, that'd be cool. Anyone have any questions that they want to start ask? And we have a microphone, I believe, because it is streaming. We want to make sure people hear it.
As a 20-year-old student going to Noman, I'd love to direct movies sometime in my life, but where did you see at 20 years old or at some young age, did you think you'd be directing a huge movie like these? Or?
Go ahead, Joe.
20. No, not never. At 20, I was in college. I was studying mechanical engineering and knew I wanted to do something creative, but didn't know what. And one of my professors recommended I check out architecture school. So that sent me on that path. But filmmaking, I loved films, but never thought it could actually do it for a living at that point.
I was still waiting tables at 26, and then I started freelancing illustration, and then got into computers, and so it didn't occur to me to even think about making a film till maybe I was early 30s, and I can tell you that I don't advise waiting till you're 50. That was unfortunate, but fortunate in that if I was 30, you know, I probably would have had a whole different experience. I would have been trying to screw all the actresses and getting drunk every night and doing all kinds of stupid things. And instead at 50, I could keep my libido in check. And it's still there. I want the internet to know, but it's just under control. No, and I had the experience of having run a company, which making a movie is a lot like running a company. It's spending a lot of money in a very short amount of time. And, you know, you learn how to talk to people without making them hate you and telling them what to do. And so I think my advice would be not to rush to do that. And to, there's so many, when you get your chance, you'll be so much better if you've done lots of different things along the way to learn, because otherwise you're gonna be standing. Look, at 50, the first thing I did when I went on set was say, I don't know what the fuck I'm doing. All you people here, I've never directed a movie before. I'm not gonna pretend like I have. And the funny thing is everybody there knows your job and their own better than you do, in my case anyway. And so I just begged for their help and assistance, which really worked out well for me. When I was 30, I was more arrogant, and I would have been afraid to say that. I would have been, I gotta look like I know what I'm doing. I gotta seem like I'm in control. At 50, I don't give a fuck. You know, you're gonna like me or you're not, and that's the way it is. But you know, don't rush to be in that position, because if you make a bad movie because you're young and inexperienced, it's hard to get another chance. So just make sure you're ready would be my advice. And stay in the game. Like, it'd be easy to go, hey, I'm never gonna make it, and quit.
Right.
And if you just keep in the game, if you're just present, at some point, maybe everybody else will fall down and they'll hand you a camera and you can do it. Maybe Joe's got different advice.
No, I think that's great advice. There's certainly, you're going to hear a lot of no's before you get a yes, but that's part of the process.
Yeah, I think that's the thing that people don't realize is like you have to make a lot of movies or a lot of things and just keep practicing and practicing and practicing, right? I mean, I've got my good friend Dan Thron here, and I know he's done a ton of stuff, but he does really great stuff, and some of it falls flat. But the best thing that he does is he comes up with like 3 movie ideas a day, practically, you know? And that's what it is. It's not like, all right, I have 1 movie idea and it's gonna be huge and I'm gonna get $100 million and it's gonna get done. Like, you gotta have a lot of ideas to throw away before one sticks. And you don't know which one's gonna stick, right?
Yep. The idea, you know, Kubrick called the director the idea and taste machine. Like, you're just, you have to,
yeah.
You just have to be willing to. I think also there's this game you have to be able to play where, when you're pitching a project or going after a project, you have to convince yourself it's the most important thing in the world to yourself. But the moment you find out that it's not going to happen, you have to be able to wipe it away like it was never there and make yourself as excited as you can about the next one. And it's this kind of weird thing that you start doing where you create that, you have this passion for something, but you have to know that when it's over, it's over, and you can't sit around and be bummed about it. You had to have, you know, your next 5 things lined up. And for me, commercials was a great training ground for that, actually. I mean, yeah, Tron is my first film, but in a weird way, having done a couple of big spots.
Halo spot.
Like the Halo spot, which I stole from Tim.
That was really cute.
Well done. Well played.
Yeah. And more than that, the Halo was a huge victory. Well, see, now I'm admitting to it. Now I'm admitting to it, weirdly, even though I don't remember.
You're laughing, but that spot really was like a big spot for you, that Halo
spot. It was
spot.
My second spot. It was my second job, yeah.
But it got a lot of, it was a great spot. Yeah, and it got a lot of recognition. The end of it sucked, but
I know, you hated it. That's right.
Yeah.
Now I understand where the criticism comes from. It's just jealousy.
You beat my bid because when I bid on this spot, it was a giant army, and then when Master Chief jumps off the cliff, and then I see your final spot, and there's like 2 warthogs, and
that was,
you know,
a choice,
a couple
man.
Of dudes.
That was a choice. Yeah, like, that was a choice.
That motherfucker.
No, but before the Halo spot and the spot before that, which was Gears of War, there were 24.
That was a beautiful spot.
Oh, I love that.
There were 24 pitches I had done that I didn't get.
Yeah.
So it was the year of pitching every 2 weeks, and
that's a soul destroying exercise.
And that is where I think you realize you either that's where the people give up. 24 pitches in a row, and you feel like you're not going to get it, and you get really close a couple of times, but no one really wants to give you that first shot, and then.
And that must be really if you're a creative person. Like already you're putting your work out there, your heart's on your sleeve, you're validated.
You're
by
putting, like I said, you're putting everything into it. Like, this is the most important fabric softener commercial ever to be made.
And it's a completely different skill set.
And you make yourself care, like it is. And
I was a compositor, and I was working at this place, actually just down the street. It used to be here, Action Video was my first job out here. And, you know, I was doing Spanish Pampers commercials. And they were the best fucking Spanish Pampers commercials you ever.
I bet they were.
Yeah, because I wanted to do a great job. I cared.
Yeah.
But I would also say that you have to have some kind of sick little thing inside you that, like, every time you lose, it just I don't know. I felt almost there was some part of me that was glad. Like, I don't want it to be easy because when I get there, I'm gonna deserve it. You know,
you're so ready. I mean, when I got Gears of War, I was so ready to make something.
To prove yourself,
And I remember, you know, Dave Morrison called me. He's like, "You got the job. Now don't fuck it up." And hung up. And that was that was basically.
Dave still says that.
I know.
Yeah,
and rightly so. He was very, very right.
That's what he said about Deadpool. Don't fuck it up.
Yeah.
My best compliment was Deadpool was done and had come out and had done really well. And I had dinner with Fincher afterwards. So we sit down. He hadn't said anything. I didn't even know if he'd seen the movie. And he sat down and I said, "Did you see the movie yet?" He goes, "Yeah, I saw it." I said, "And?" He goes, "It's all right." So here's what we're gonna do next. We're gonna, you know, we're gonna fuck this studio and that studio. And,
that's a huge compliment from him.
Yeah. It's all right.
That's huge.
Yeah, because I was expecting something entirely different.
Right.
Like I'm ashamed to be seen with you. Or, David Fincher's opinion. He's the nicest guy. I know his reputation is like horrible, but he's the nicest, funniest guy you'll ever meet. But he's David Fincher, so it's just so hard to show your. Another director friend of ours just did his first feature, and he didn't. David said, I don't know why he didn't show me this earlier, this feature. And I said, I know why. The same reason I didn't show you Deadpool, because I was terrified. I knew he would go, oh, my God, I can't believe I wasted time being your friend. You suck. but he didn't.
But he didn't.
But yeah, and it's not his kind of movie either. So.
Do you have another question?
Thank you. I have a question for you. You said you worked on Tron. So what was the process of updating from like an 80s look? Like you were talking about Mobius earlier. He worked on the Tron movies, costume design, just how the whole film looked aesthetically. So did that inspire you to make Tron look the way it did now?
Yeah, definitely. For me, Tron was always about the lines of light, the kind of featureless black planes. But I wanted it to have a physical reality, which is, you know, I wanted everything to be glass or stone, to feel real. I wanted it, you know, at the time, what I said is I want to feel like we go into this world and we've shot this all with a camera on the inside. The materiality is Tron, but I want it to feel real. I didn't want it to feel graphic. And, you know, the original Tron was physically shot. It wasn't. Animators drew on top of black and white sets to give it that look. So I wanted to create the 2010 version of that, which was a physically based, photoreal world.
Ray traced
world. But that felt like what I remembered Tron was to me. So to keep that kind of sense of minimalism. I don't know. For whatever reason, I was able to see it very clearly at that point.
Do you play the video game?
Of course. Yeah.
I love that game.
Yeah, it's apparently one of the most expensive and hardest ones to repair because it's four motherboards, one for each.
Yeah, that's
module.
Why I liked it because it was four. Each level
it's a great
was so
game.
Different. Yeah, it was.
It's
great.
A great game. The music, everything. I still feel like even to this day, Tron still kind of owns that certain aesthetic. And if any brand tries to put it in a commercial or something, everyone's like, you know, Tron-like is, you know. So whatever what Steven created in 1979 or whenever he started that, it's amazing that it's still kind of.
There's even a Tron first-person shooter.
Is there?
Yeah, Tron Evolution, I think.
Yeah, they did a game and they actually just opened a ride in Shanghai, which was,
I saw that. It's like
amazing.
A light cycle roller coaster.
Yeah, you ride on a light cycle in Shanghai. It looks amazing.
The animated show was really well designed.
That was good.
That was really good. Wasn't that the same animator who did Aeon Flux?
Peter Chung.
Wasn't that the same guy?
Yeah.
It seems like a similar style. I'm just guessing.
I don't know.
No, it's a guy named Charlie who I think is doing the next Lego movie.
Batman?
Not Lego Batman. Oh. I want to say Ninjago.
Ninjago,
I think so. I think that's what he's doing next,
I like Ninjago, actually. I watch that with my kids sometimes. It's actually entertaining.
We did the original Lego test. They came to us, we did this test, and all we were supposed to do was, like, how do the Legos look when they're talking, and I threw it to one of our director, and he was an animation supervisor, too. And I said, Jeff, figure out how Lego's talking would look. Just write some little scripts so we can test something. And he came back the next day with this whole page and a half story for this Lego test. And it was so good that we just did it. We just made it as a test. And Dan Lin, and he said this in another podcast, so I'm not talking out of school, but Dan Lin, up until then, everybody had been like, Lego, we're not so sure what it'll be like. And this test, if you could see it, is really cute and smart. And
was that ever released?
Is it what?
Did they show it on the?
Well, we gave it to Warner Brothers and said, hey, you know, and they liked it so much that Jeff actually pitched to direct the movie.
Oh, nice.
And he had a really good take. The movie that they made was good. Jeff had a different take that right. kind of took the Legos out into the real world, mm-hmm. and it, or the CG world. And it was just really interesting. But it was a great example of just how you can really just clarify what a story could be, like your test, like Deadpool did for me.
Right.
Which, you know, when I showed it to the studio, the Deadpool test, they said, oh, that's cool. I'm still not making the movie, but...
Yeah. Wow. And they paid for it?
Yeah. Well, they paid for part of it, and then it's nice to own a CG studio, so you can,
yeah.
you can do some shit in your spare time. I call it monopoly money. I mean, we're pretty busy. Blur's pretty busy all the time, but there's always, you know, this guy's got 3 days and that girl's got 2 days, and you know, you can
throw them on stuff.
You
That's
can
great.
Steal shit and do it.
That's what happened with one of the other podcasts I did with Spaz Williams. He was supposed to be working on some Japanese whiskey commercial or something like that, and he was like kind of doing that, but most of the time he was building the T-Rex, and that ended up going in front of Kathleen Kennedy. It proved to them that they can do Jurassic Park.
I'd just like to clarify that that's not happens with our clients. Our clients get 110% of every artist. No, we would just have, you know, projects. You got a bunch of projects around, and you can't utilize everybody at 100%.
Or they're between projects. So
they're between projects, yeah. Just to clarify, we don't want anybody thinking.
No. Because
we work for Joe all the time.
I'd like to have one more question.
I was like, no wonder those were just kidding me.
I'm going to ask one more question to you guys, and that's if you guys can tell us a little bit about what some of the exciting things you guys are doing next. I know you're in the middle of post on something. I don't know how much you can talk about that.
Yeah, no, I can talk about it. I just finished, I shot a movie over the summer that's called Granite Mountain. It's very different than the other two movies I've done, which is what I love about it. It's a story about a group of wildland firefighters. It's a true story. 20 wildland firefighters who are, they were called hotshots. It means they're like kind of the Navy SEALs of wildland firefighters. They get dropped into huge forest fires and fight fire without water. They go in with axes and chainsaws and shovels, and they fight wildfire. And they're amazing at what they do. And this is the story of a group that went in to fight a wildfire in Arizona in 2013. And unfortunately, only one of them survived the fire. So it's Josh Brolin, Miles Teller, Jeff Bridges, Jennifer Connelly, Taylor Kitsch, James Badge-Dale, just
wow.
a huge...
Great cast.
Amazing cast, amazing drama, and...
amazing director.
Thank you.
Amazing
director. No, just a really, really important story, and that'll be out probably next fall.
Okay, yeah. Cool. And you're working with Eric Barba on it as
Barba,
well?
Yeah, Eric Barba and ILM are doing the visual effects. We're doing CG Fire, which is awesome. Very...
That's challenging.
Which is hard, yeah.
Yeah, very, tough. Very challenging. And Tim, can you say anything about what's going on your side?
No, I can't.
Okay.
I can't. Well, Deadpool 2. Oh, wait. No, sorry. Not doing that. Still recovering. Blur is working on a project that I can't say what it is, but I can say that it is something that animation fans will be... It's something I've wanted to do for a long time, and I think animation aficionados will appreciate it. It is really one for people that love animation, and it'll be out not next year, but the following year. And then I have a bunch of other projects that are, I wouldn't even say they're quite, development sounds so nebulous. They're in development, but they're happening on some level. And all I can say is, if you knew what they were, and if you're fans of science fiction and nerds in general, it's like a wet dream of nerd projects. I mean, it really is. Like, if I told you what it was, you would go, holy fucking shit, you are the luckiest geek on the planet. Because
nice.
they're just amazing. I'm a huge sci-fi fan, like Joe, too.
It's not Power Rangers, because that's already done. That's already
If only. No, it's really great. I mean, I read a lot. I love books. I love stories. And again, another thing that happens by the fact that Deadpool happened so late in my life, I have this big compendium of shit I wanted to do. So surprisingly, when you make a movie that makes a lot of money, people suddenly are interested in what you want to do next. Even though, I'll say for the record that, you know, I'm not some guy that sits back and says, I'm so awesome. Deadpool, I got really lucky. I hit the zeitgeist right. I look at the movie and see so much that I could have done better, so much that I would do better next time. But it made a lot of money, and that impresses some people. But I feel very fortunate. So then it allows you, if you have that, when people come and go, hey, what do you want to do next? I go, here's 12 books that I think are fucking awesome. Right. And, you know, and people listen a little more. So I was able to set up a bunch of stuff in development that I think is really great, and some of it is going to happen.
That's awesome.
Very exciting. That's an awesome a lot of no information, right?
Very smart.
I want to do one last thing. Is we've got a Polaroid here. We do Polaroids of all of our guests now.
Cool.
I don't know if you saw that before, so we'll do a Polaroid picture.
Just to be contrarian, or?
Well,
it's hipster, it's organic, it's
no,
locally
it was
sourced,
actually,
it's retro.
Listen, it was
reactionary. Made with kale, that's kale.
I basically told Melissa, I was like, I want to have like a guest book of some kind, and she said, why don't we just do Polaroids and people can sign them, and I've got some great pictures of some great people that I've been with, and it's so fun. So anyway, I'm going to do a Polaroid with you guys, and then we're going to sign off the podcast, if that's cool. Hold on. All right. You guys hang out together? All right.
Now we are going to make out.
Hold on a second. Make sure.
Batteries.
How
down.
Do you use this?
No, no, no.
What is this thing?
I want to get everything.
Let me get out my rock and chisel. And
I'm going to do one more. Bloop. One more. All right. Thanks, guys. I appreciate it. Thanks so much for coming, guys.
Everybody.
Thank you.
Playing us out.
Thank you, everyone, for coming.
Thanks, guys.